This is KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon. Streaming at KORCFM.com.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Hey there, KORC listeners. This is Wendy Byrne with your weekly fare from the Corvallis Civics Cafe. What's coming to the table today? Well, we are missing a main course from the City Council, as they did not have meetings last week. But we won't go hungry. I've prepared dishes about other local civic events. For this episode, 3 city meetings to review, 2 county-related items worth following, and a discussion about meetings for next week. Ready, set, go! On Tuesday, March 25th, there was a meeting of the Corvallis Climate Action Advisory Board. This board is charged with helping Corvallis meet its greenhouse gas emissions target from the Corvallis Climate Action Plan, a plan that was adopted 9 years ago in 2016. The board provides advice and policy recommendations to the City Council. There are 7 community members currently on the board, and membership can expand as needed. Interested community members are encouraged to apply. There are those in the community and on the City Council who think our Climate Action Plan is past due for an update. I am a member of this board, and I agree that the plan could use an update. Want some hot sauce on this dish? Try this. The plan could use an update, and so could the city's approach to acting on the community side of the plan. My personal experience is that it takes far too long to get far too little accomplished in regard to effective action in the face of climate change. The thought has occurred to me that being appointed to a policy advisory board is where impassioned activists go to have their voices neutralized and their energy exhausted by being asked to focus on city policy creation, making policy recommendations that go nowhere, or worse, go into a meeting room to be detailed to death and constantly moved down the timeline and effectively never adopted, so never enacted. I thought being on the board would help make a difference in our city. After nearly 3 years, I'm not so sure. Was that too much hot sauce? Back to details about the board. Board meetings take place monthly. Recordings of past meetings and archived meeting materials, as well as the Climate Action Plan, can be found online on the city website at corvallisoregon.gov. If you are interested in more information or want to apply for the Climate Action Advisory Board, you can connect with the city's innovation manager by email at abby.alexander@corvallisoregon.gov. That's abby.alexander@corvallisoregon.gov. On Wednesday, March 26th, there was a meeting of the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan Update Task Force. Did you know that Corvallis owns a forest and a watershed? The Rock Creek Watershed contains the Corvallis Forest and is one of the city's main sources of water. Our primary source of drinking water is the Willamette River. The secondary source of drinking water is the Rock Creek Watershed, which provides around half of the city's water supply during the winter months. The Corvallis Forest is managed by the city. Best management practices involve having a plan, and ours is called the Corvallis Forest Stewardship Plan. In fiscal year 2022-2023, the city initiated an update of its plan. The update is following a public participation process and includes the volunteer task force of community members with expertise in natural resources, ecology, and land management. Since early 2023, the task force has been meeting monthly and is drawing close to completion of its efforts. The first draft of the updated plan could be ready this summer. At the March 26th meeting, the task force discussed desired future conditions of the forest. They also discussed monitoring policy, standards, and guidelines. Do you have comments or questions you would like to share with the task force? You can provide input via email at cfsputf@corvallisoregon.gov. That's a mouthful of letters. Let me repeat it for you. The email address is cfsputf@corvallisoregon.gov. Their meetings take place toward the end of each month and are hybrid, so you can attend them in person or remotely. As with all city policy boards, commissions, and task forces, you can sign up for email notifications by going to corvallisoregon.gov/subscribe. On Wednesday the 26th, there was a second city-related event. At the public library, city staff hosted an open house for a presentation and interactive discussion about the work of the Downtown Parking Task Force. This task force was created to address parking-related changes that were recommended after a professional audit of the city's parking program. Don't worry, it has not been suggested to eliminate free parking. It has, however, been strongly suggested to manage the parking in the downtown area in a way that would reorganize and redistribute the parking, simplify the system, relocate the free parking areas around downtown, and change the way the city-owned off-street parking lots are managed. Both the city and the downtown merchants will benefit from the changes that have been recommended. If you want to join me in going deep on understanding the data, you can read the series of 8 white papers published by the consultant about parking. That and much more can be found on the city website under Corvallis Public Parking Audit. Don't want to do the reading? Just want to know what to expect? Expect change. Not aware that the city has been working on updating how parking is managed in our downtown? You are not alone. Thank goodness I'm here to tell you about it. Kidding aside, several of the attendees at the open house expressed frustration with what they claimed was lack of transparency regarding the plans to change parking downtown. One person implied that the city has been intentionally keeping the information from the public. I assure you, this is not the case. I have been following this subject for at least 3 years on and off now, as it has been discussed at meetings of the Planning Commission and the City Council. All 8 meetings that the Downtown Parking Task Force has had up to this time have been publicized on the city calendar of events as well as on social media. Parking is a sensitive subject, and many people approach it with preconceived beliefs and a misunderstanding of the goals of parking. I know, I've been there. Personally, I'm glad that I had the time and interest to read the reports. Now I understand how properly managed parking can be a useful tool to help build a thriving downtown. That angry person at the open house, the one who thought the city was trying to hide things from the public, they are not alone in their frustration, but the information is there for the finding. Most days we suffer from information overload. Watch this, read that, keep up on all the details. How is it best for city officials to communicate with the public? They can promote things on social media, or put ads in the local papers, and folks like me can read about the events on the radio. But how can they inform all of the people about all of the things? Social media is a false promise. The city can post information there, but if the algorithm does not want you to see it, you will likely miss it. Ads in the paper? Do you read the paper? You can help yourself gain and maintain awareness about city-related items that are of interest to you by signing up for city notifications. Go to corvallisoregon.gov/subscribe. corvallisoregon.gov/subscribe. At the very least, subscribe to the Corvallis e-news. That newsletter will keep you aware of a myriad of things about the city. Want updates about the Osborne Aquatic Center? It's in there. Want to follow the Planning Commission? Sign up for their notifications. Help yourself to information, and then help Corvallis be a better city by being an informed resident. Okay, time to get off that soapbox. What happened to me? What else tasty is coming to the table today? Have you noticed the yard signs around town that say, quote, "Stop the landfill expansion," end quote? Are you aware that our dump, the Coffin Butte Landfill, is not owned by the city of Corvallis? It's not even owned by Benton County. Let me read you this very short history of the landfill, which is taken directly from the county's webpage. Quote, "The landfill was created in the 1940s by the U.S. Army for the waste disposal from the former Camp Adair. It was expanded and designated a regional landfill in 1974. Valley Landfills Incorporated purchased it in 1975 for use as a municipal landfill. Republic Services Incorporated became the parent company of the landfill in a 2008 merger." Period. End quote. Since 2008, you had better believe that Republic Services is making good money off the landfill. In fact, they would love to expand it and continue to pack it full of trash from all over Western Oregon. Fully 1/3 of all the garbage in Western Oregon comes to this dump. Less than 7% comes from Benton County, and some garbage comes from out of state. Let me repeat that. Fully 1/3 of all the garbage in Western Oregon comes to this dump. Less than 7% comes from Benton County, our county, and some garbage comes from out of state. Republic Services recently submitted their formal application to expand the landfill, and the county's Planning Commission will be holding hearings and deliberations before they decide whether to recommend accepting the expansion. Ultimately, your county commissioners will vote on the application. The first day of the county hearing about the landfill expansion is set for April 29th. Public comment on this subject is welcome and encouraged. To get your comments officially on the record before the hearing opens, they need to be submitted by 5 p.m. on April 21st. There is more information and guidance on the county website at bentoncountyor.gov. In-depth, independently gathered details about the landfill can be found at coffinbuttefacts.org. At coffinbuttefacts.org, you will find detailed information about the environmental and financial burdens of allowing the landfill to expand at this location. Before I move off this topic, I will add this. Based on geology and rainfall, a new landfill at this location would never be allowed to open, so why should it be allowed to expand? While we are talking about county-related civics, Benton County is updating its comprehensive plan, and they want our input. What's a comprehensive plan? All counties in Oregon are required to have such a plan. I'll read this definition from the county website. Quote, "A comprehensive plan is a document that outlines the county's long-term vision and goals for future development, including land use, transportation, housing, public facilities, and more. It is a blueprint for how a community wants to grow and evolve over time, incorporating resident input and considering current situations." End quote. Why is your input important? The county, like the city, does want to take your opinions into consideration. Do you value protecting agricultural land over improving infrastructure? Or is it more important to promote economic development? Should the county be more focused on emergency preparedness? As they update their plan, the county will take guidance from us as to how to weight the various categories. They want to hear from all of us, wherever we live in Benton County. How can you give input? In March, there were several open house events in all areas of the county to gather input from community members. And if you missed those, there is an online survey, but it closes on April 4th. That is soon. Despite their efforts at outreach, I just found out about it. Who knew? Please, please go share your opinions with the county via their survey. Go to their website by typing, quote, "Benton Believes," unquote, into the browser of your choice. That's Benton, B-E-N-T-O-N, Believes, B-E-L-I-E-V-E-S. And once you are there, look for the Get Involved tab in the upper left part of the page. This will take you to the survey, and it's only open until April 4th, so get to it. I'll close with a three-layer cake about upcoming meetings. On Monday, March 31st, the City Council is having a special work session. It will start at 5 p.m. and can be observed online via Zoom or attended in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue. What's special about this work session? Due to the way their meetings fell in March, there was time for an extra meeting, so the council is taking advantage to fit in discussion about some important topics. Namely, they will discuss their city council code of conduct and review their priorities for this term. It should be interesting to know what changes they might suggest for the code of conduct and what priorities they will set for the next 21 months. On Wednesday, April 2nd, the Planning Commission will meet at 6:30 p.m. Planning Commission meetings are online only. Go to the city website at corvallisoregon.gov for detailed instructions on how to register for this meeting. At this week's meeting, the Planning Commission will hold hearings about adoption of the city's climate-friendly areas and about sign regulation standards updates. The full agenda and packet of information for the meeting is available on the city website. On Thursday, April 3rd, there will be an open house for the Safe Streets for All project at the Corvallis Public Library. The City of Corvallis and Benton County are working together to make streets safer for everyone, whether you walk, bike, roll, use transit, or drive. This open house event will take place from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, April 3rd at the Corvallis Library, 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. Attendees will have an opportunity to share their safety concerns and help shape future improvements to our roads. Come to the library and engage with City of Corvallis and Benton County staff and project team members. Family-friendly activities and Spanish interpretation will be available. That's a wrap for this edition of the Corvallis Civics Cafe. Thanks for listening to my mix of information and opinion. Do you have hot sauce to share? Send it my way. If you have comments or questions about the material I've shared, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's news, music, and civics, email us at news@korcfm.com. The show airs on Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m. and repeats on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. and Civics Cafe can also be heard on Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. following The Many Moods of Ben Vaughn.
This is Dan Kroll. I recently stayed at a casino hotel. I made the reservation here because it was a short trip and my 8-year-old wanted to stay somewhere that had an indoor pool. The casino was located in Northern California, not far from the Redwoods, which was the true purpose of this trip, to kick off this year's academic spring break. The hotel property was nice, and a small-scale casino in comparison to larger resort casinos throughout the Northwest. I felt drawn to the game room to check out the action. The room was filled with cigarette smoke. It reminded me of being back in the Chicagoland in the late 90s. Rows of people, mostly elderly and some middle-aged, played the slots, occasionally looking up as I walked around, slowly observing. I tried not to appear as too much of an outsider or to stare at anyone for too long. An elderly woman sat at the same machine for at least an hour, a stack of $20 bills going into the machine, one bill after the other. A few rows over, a woman won a jackpot of over $100, and without celebrating, looking excited, or perhaps cashing out to enjoy the winnings, she kept hitting the buttons. A man nearby played on two machines while compulsively wiping his nose. The sound of games and clicking abounded in this room. I remembered that the warm sounds of these machines was and always has been my favorite part of walking around casinos. Gambling is an addiction and habit that I have thus far been fortunate enough to avoid. I walked over to the restaurant to order some food to go. While waiting on my food order, I sat down at one of the older machines that advertises one penny bets, and I put in $1. Realizing that 100 spins with likely no reward wasn't in the cards for tonight, I assumed the food would be ready soon, so I began betting larger amounts, like 5 cents, 20 cents, and doing double bets. Just before my balance reached zero, I was up to $1 and some change, so I made some larger bets, hoping to zero down. Before I knew it, it was up from my initial $1 to $5.40. I immediately printed my ticket and proudly presented it to the cashier in a nearby cage. A man nearby chewed on his paper cup, his coffee almost spilling on his already stained gray sweatpants. A sad song played on the speaker overhead. As I retreated to the hotel room with the to-go food, and my son not feeling well and wanting to just lay down, I was drawn back to the game room, to people watch, and to enjoy the ambient drone of the machines. There's an element and aesthetic of sadness mixed with the flashing lights, the welcoming yellow and orange sounds, friendly graphics, and what feels like company in a room full of strangers. Many of us get lonelier as we age, and there is a range of entertainment and vices that are presented as something to do, options that feel welcoming. I have always recognized the slippery slope of casinos and gambling addiction. I have a longtime belief that most of the machines are rigged against the gambler's favor. Otherwise, how would the casino survive? And as an aging elder millennial, I feel the next stage of life creeping in. If one were to look at the advertisements for casinos with happy, attractive young adults in groups winning big, smiling and laughing, it's easy to long for the experience. And before you know it, you may experience some wins. And then before you know it, it's become a compulsion. It's no longer a fun game. It's not a special occasion anymore. Many casinos, including this one I stayed at in Northern California, are open 24 hours. Anton LaVey once said, "Indulgence, not compulsion. The highest plateau of human development is the awareness of the flesh." A habit such as gambling, where hundreds of dollars or more can disappear in a matter of a few clicks, and once the habit begins, it's hardly fathomable that if you make any winnings, that you're going to be ahead more than what you have wasted. As someone with addictive tendencies who is also aging, trying to keep loneliness away the best I can, this ordinary trip to a casino to spend time, inhale the secondhand smoke, strike up a few small conversations, and enjoy the soundscape was a reminder. Vices and addictions present their opportunity everywhere. According to psychiatry.org, gambling disorder is identified by a pattern of repeated and ongoing betting and wagering that continues despite creating multiple problems in several areas of an individual's life. Individuals in any group may suffer from gambling disorder. Those who suffer from the disorder have trouble controlling the habit of gambling. The American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-5, considers gambling disorder as a behavioral addiction. In fact, it's currently the only behavioral addiction that the DSM-5 recognizes. In certain ways, gambling disorder resembles substance use disorder. There are recommended strategies for dealing with cravings to gamble, including distract yourself with other activities, postpone gambling. Giving yourself time may allow the urge to pass or at least weaken. Stop for a moment and consider what will happen when you gamble. Avoid isolation. That last point is perhaps what hits home the most for me. Since the COVID pandemic, and also as a man approaching mid-40s, I feel the sting of loneliness, or at least the reminders that it could increasingly become my destiny that manifests, especially if I don't remember to treat those I love and value the best I can, and remember to give in to good hobbies and good anchors, and not slip into the habit or addiction of gambling. There are a number of online resources to help you if you have a problem with gambling or if you think you may have a problem. You can do an internet search for Oregon Gambling Hotline, and several resources will appear on the first page of results. Don't be too hard on yourself. Life is challenging. Many of us don't make it through life without having at least one or two addictions to really face and hopefully erase. For KORC, News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Kroll.
This is Wendy Byrne with a list of city meetings and special events for the week starting Sunday, March 30th. On Monday, March 31st, the City Council will meet in executive session to conduct deliberations with persons designated by the governing body to negotiate real property transactions. The public is not allowed to attend executive sessions. This executive session will be held in the Madison Avenue Meeting Room at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue and will start at 4:30 p.m. on Monday, March 31st. Also on Monday, March 31st, at 5 p.m., there will be a City Council special work session. Everyone is welcome and encouraged to attend City Council meetings. This work session will be held in person and virtually. The meeting agenda and packet can be found online at CorvallisOregon.gov. The meeting will take place at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue in downtown Corvallis. On Tuesday, April 1st, at the Corvallis Community Center, there will be a Red Cross blood drive. Did you know that 14,000 units of blood must be collected every day to meet patient needs across our communities? The City of Corvallis is hosting a Red Cross blood drive this week at the Corvallis Community Center starting at noon on Tuesday, April 1st. No fooling, they need our help. Please donate if you can. The Corvallis Community Center is located at 2601 Northwest Tyler Avenue. On Wednesday, April 2nd, there will be a meeting of the Corvallis Planning Commission at 6:30 p.m. This Planning Commission meeting will be conducted online only. Community members are encouraged to attend. The meeting agenda and packet can be found online at corvallisoregon.gov. On Thursday, April 3rd, starting at 5 p.m., there will be a Safe Streets for All open house. The City of Corvallis and Benton County are working together to make streets safer for everyone, whether you walk, bike, roll, use transit, or drive. This open house event will take place from 5 to 7 p.m. on April 3rd at the Corvallis Library, located at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue. Attendees can learn more about the Safe Streets and Roads for All project that aims to improve transportation safety in Corvallis and in Benton County. You'll have an opportunity to share your safety concerns and help shape future improvements, as well as engage with City of Corvallis and Benton County staff and project team members. Family-friendly activities and Spanish interpretation will be available. Again, please join us for the Safe Streets for All open house on Thursday, April 3rd, starting at 5 p.m. in the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library. On Saturday, April 5th at 9 a.m., there will be a legislative breakfast. Depending on attendance, this event could create a possible quorum of the City Council. No decisions will be made and no quorum is required. This legislative breakfast will take place at the Benton County Kalapuya Building at 4500 Southwest Research Way. On Saturday, April 5th, Ward 3's Councilor Jim Moorfield will host Government Comment Corner at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library from 10 a.m. to 12 noon. Please stop by and say hello and ask your questions about local government. The Corvallis-Benton County Public Library is located at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. The following portion of an article is from the Corvallis Gazette Times, published on March 28, 2025, and is authored by Ella Hutcherson. Headline reads, Samaritan Health Notifies Bank of Default and is Open to Buyout. Corvallis-based Samaritan Health Services has informed its bank it may be in default of a loan agreement by not having enough available income. The disclosure comes as the health system serving Linn and Benton counties and beyond struggles with a host of financial pressures. It also comes during a time of transition, with the proposed absorption of a smaller healthcare organization and the imminent departure of its current CEO. Chief Financial Officer Daniel Smith delivered the news of plausible default in a quarterly report signed February 25th and provided it to U.S. Bank. It says Samaritan may not have enough income on hand, violating the terms of debt incurred in 2010, with terms updated in 2020, constituting a, quote, non-payment-related default, unquote. In addition, another loan, this one with Key Government Finance Incorporated, a division of Key Bank of Cleveland, and financed with a bond, is in similar peril. Both creditors asked for a fixed charge ratio, which shows a company's ability to cover its debts, of 1.10 times, meaning it has the cash flow to pay its fixed charges and interest 1.10 times out of earnings. One possible solution to these difficulties is Samaritan itself being absorbed by a larger partner, according to a news site that specifically writes about Oregon's healthcare industry. In Smith's disclosure, he writes that Samaritan experienced financial challenges in the 2024 fiscal year related to, quote, decreasing payments from health insurance companies, declining payer mix, and increased utilization on its health plans in excess of premiums received. He also cites industry-wide pressure on expenses like labor and supplies, as well as general inflation. Samaritan has retained a consultant to make recommendations to increase income available for debt service for the 2025 fiscal year, Smith writes. This will either be to the level required or, if the consultant determines it impractical, to the level attainable. According to previous reporting from the Lund Report, all options are on the table for the health system. But for Samaritan, it's likely practical to follow the statewide movement toward growth, which could include bringing on a partner, a larger partner. That's according to CEO Don Boyson, who told the Lund Report that Samaritan acknowledges residents' need for access to local health services, even if absorption means they are not provided under the Samaritan name. Samaritan currently has 5 community hospitals, more than 100 physician clinics, and multiple health insurance plans that serve 290,000 residents in Oregon's Benton, Lincoln, and Linn counties, according to a news release from May 2024. The organization employs 6,000 plus workers and is governed by a volunteer board. Since last year, according to the Lund Report, Samaritan cut 200 jobs system-wide, reduced hours for some employees, and temporarily lowered executive pay. Also last year, Samaritan signed a definitive agreement to incorporate Santiam Hospital and Clinics based in Marion and Linn counties, with most operations based in Staten, into Samaritan Health Services. The healthcare organization serves more than 40,000 residents, employs more than 500 staff, and has 12 clinics serving Staten and nearby communities, according to its website. The two entities are seeking Oregon Health Authority approval of the deal for this summer. Under the terms of the proposed acquisition, according to the Lund Report, Samaritan would build a $15 million medical office facility in Staten and would supply the smaller hospital with $10.5 million for capital expenses. It would also assume about $25 million in debt that Santiam owes to the federal government and to Key Bank. In December, Boyson, Samaritan's CEO and president since 2017, announced that he's planning to step down from his role sometime this year. According to the Lund Report, the board is evaluating candidates, and Boyson expects a decision to be announced within the next month and a half. Recommendations from Samaritan's consultant regarding debt service are anticipated for May of this year. That was a story from the Corvallis Gazette Times, dated March 28, 2025, authored by Ella Hutcherson, and entitled Samaritan Health Notifies Bank of Default and is Open to Buyout. And you're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall. Hearing dates have been set for the landfill expansion application, and the public comment period is now open. The Benton County Planning Division has announced the schedule for the public hearing on Republic Services' conditional use permit application for the proposed expansion of the Coffin Butte landfill. The public comment period is now open. The following dates have been set for the hearing before the Benton County Planning Commission. On Tuesday, April 29th from 6 to 9 p.m., that will be day one, including the staff report, applicant presentation, and the start of public testimony if time permits. On Thursday, May 1st from 6 to 9 p.m., it will be day two, the starting or continuing of the public testimony. Tuesday, May 6th, from 6 to 9 p.m., will be a continuation of public testimony as necessary. And on Tuesday, June 17th, from 6 p.m. until, Whenever they complete the process, that will be day four with deliberations and decisions on the application for the landfill expansion. The hearing will be held at the county's Kalapuya building, which is located at 4500 Southwest Research Way in Corvallis. Anyone can sign up as an interested party to receive updates about the status of the application and changes or additions to the schedule. Members of the public can now submit written testimony about the CUP application. Comments should be submitted up to 8 days before the hearing begins to be included in the Planning Division staff report for the Planning Commission and agency referral partners. Written testimony received after the staff report is posted and up to the start of the public hearing will be delivered in hard copy to the Planning Commission. Written testimony submitted during the public hearing should be handed to the meeting recorder, and after the public hearing, all written comments that were not in the original staff report will be added to the record and posted to the county website in one action. Members of the public can also sign up to share verbal testimony during the hearing. An online sign-up system will be released about a week before the hearing begins, which is Tuesday, April 29th, the beginning of the hearing. Although this option will be available, the community is encouraged to provide written comments in advance so Planning Commission members, county staff, and the public have time to consider all perspectives and prepare to respond at the hearing. This also allows for the most efficient use of meeting time. Republic Services submitted additional material for the CUP application on March 14th of this year. This addendum to the burden of proof submitted on January 15th is publicly available on the MooneyDocs platform as Landfill Expansion Application, First Addendum to Burden of Proof. The Benton County Planning Division is working to incorporate this new information into the staff report. You can learn more about the decision process by visiting bentoncountyor.gov/coffin-butte-landfill. bentoncountyor.gov/coffin-butte-landfill. The hearing begins Tuesday, April 29th at 6 p.m. at the Kalapuya Building located on Research Way in Corvallis. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall.
The following is a selection of headlines from last week on the program Democracy Now! More about the show, including recordings of full episodes, can be found at democracynow.org.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A 7.7 magnitude earthquake has hit central Burma, also known as Myanmar, with powerful tremors felt across Thailand and China. At least 20 people have been reported dead after the quake struck near Mandalay, Burma's second largest city, followed by a strong 6.4 aftershock 11 minutes later. Hospital patients were forced to evacuate to a parking lot, many still hooked up to intravenous drips and oxygen tanks as the earthquake rattled the city. Buildings were left in ruins while power lines and several bridges collapsed. Dozens of injured people have been rushed to the hospital. Burma's military regime has declared a state of emergency across six regions, including in the capital, Naypyidaw. Burma is one of Asia's poorest nations, still reeling from a devastating war sparked by a military coup in 2021. Humanitarian aid groups have warned of challenges in assessing the true toll of the damage and accessing impacted communities due to the ongoing conflict between the Burmese military and other militia groups. Electricity and communication lines are also down. In Thailand, at least three people were reported dead in Bangkok when a 30-story skyscraper that was under construction collapsed. Dozens remain buried. Pre-dawn attacks by Israel have killed at least 14 people in Gaza. In total, more than 830 Palestinians in Gaza, many of them children, have been killed by Israeli fire after Israel unilaterally shattered the ceasefire less than 2 weeks ago. Over a dozen aid workers have been killed or gone missing in recent days, including workers from UNRWA, Palestine Red Crescent Society, and World Central Kitchen. Israel's also escalating its attacks on Lebanon, where it's repeatedly violated the ceasefire agreed to in November. A strike this morning in the southern town of Kfar Tibnit has killed at least one person and injured eight others, including children. Meanwhile, scenes of chaos are being reported in the capital, Beirut, after Israel issued warnings to residents in the Hadath neighborhood it was about to bomb the area. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio confirmed the revoked visa of Rumeysa Öztek, a Tufts PhD student who was abducted on the streets of Somerville, Massachusetts this week by plainclothes federal agents. Öztek was targeted for writing a student op-ed about Tufts' response to Gaza solidarity protests. Rubio told reporters her case is part of a much larger scheme.
Might be more than 300 at this point. We do it every day. Every time I find one of these lunatics, I take away their visa.
You're saying it could be more than 300?
Sure, I hope. At some point, I hope we run out because we've gotten rid of all of them. But we're looking every day for these lunatics that are tearing things up. And by the way, we want to get rid of gang members, too.
In related news, a federal court in Newark is hearing arguments from the lawyers of Mahmoud Khalil today, as they argue for his case to be transferred to New Jersey and for his release from federal custody. Khalil, a former protest leader and negotiator at Columbia's encampments, was first detained, taken to New Jersey after he was arrested by ICE agents at his home in Manhattan earlier this month. He was in Columbia housing. The U.S. has reached an agreement with the Colombian government that would allow the two countries to share biometric data collected from immigrants and asylum seekers. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem praised the deal, claiming the measure would target members of criminal organizations. Colombia has become a hub for Venezuelan immigrants and others as they journey north to the United States. The agreement signals a major shift within the government of Colombian President Gustavo Petro, who had previously signaled he would not collaborate with Trump's inhumane immigration crackdown. In El Salvador, protesters took to the streets of the capital, San Salvador, to mark 3 years since President Nayib Bukele enacted a state of exception that limits constitutional protections and grants unlimited powers to Salvadoran armed forces to arrest people suspected of being gang members. The policy has also been used to target human rights advocates, land and water defenders, and others critical of Bukele's government. Some 85,000 Salvadorans have been arrested and jailed over the past 3 years without due process as their relatives demand their release. Human rights groups have documented gross violations, with dozens of Salvadorans reported dead in police custody. Tens of thousands are being indefinitely held at the same maximum security mega prison complex where the Trump administration unlawfully sent hundreds of Venezuelan immigrants and asylum seekers from the U.S.
We condemn arbitrary actions taken by President Donald Trump and followed by de facto President Nayib Bukele. We think it's a policy to criminalize poverty, a xenophobic policy. The fact that the Salvadoran state submits to these kinds of measures is an absurd submission to the criminalizing policy of the U.S.
In Turkey, police forces deployed pepper spray, rubber bullets, water cannons on student protesters who gathered in Istanbul Thursday, defying a ban on demonstrations. Massive protests have continued in Turkey for over a week, following the jailing of Istanbul's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu. seen as the biggest rival to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan ahead of elections. Over 1,900 protesters have been arrested since last week. Meanwhile, the Turkish government's escalating its crackdown on journalists, imposing a 10-day broadcast ban on an opposition TV channel.
Very harsh penalties have been issued to silence the opposition and threaten those who broadcast freely. Unfortunately, RT UK and this government is not only blacking out channels, it is also blacking out universities, young people, and their hopes.
Turkey Thursday deported a BBC reporter amidst President Erdogan's crackdown on the press. Mark Lowen was taken from his Istanbul hotel Wednesday and detained for 17 hours before being removed from Turkey. U.S. airstrikes pounded at least 40 locations across Yemen early today, including in the capital Sana'a, as the Trump administration continues its military campaign against the Houthis. At least seven people were injured, according to early on the ground reports. A coalition of advocacy groups, Dawn, Action Corps, and Just Foreign Policy, are demanding an end to the U.S. attacks, saying they violate the U.N. Charter and that, quote, Congress should stop strikes on Yemen and uphold its sole authority to declare war under Article 1 of the Constitution and the 1973 War Powers Resolution, unquote. At least 57 people have been killed since the U.S. bombing started on March 15th after Houthi fighters said they would resume Red Sea cargo attacks over Israel's renewed all-out war on Gaza. Federal Judge James Boasberg has ordered top officials, including Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, Vice President J.D. Vance, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, to preserve all communications sent on a Signal group chat in the lead-up to the March 15th attack on Yemen. The watchdog group American Oversight sued over the official's use of Signal for the exchange, which accidentally included the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine. Attorney General Pam Bondi has indicated the Justice Department is not planning to investigate the matter, despite growing bipartisan calls. Meanwhile, Axios is reporting Minnesota Democrat Congressmember Ilhan Omar is planning to introduce articles of impeachment against Pete Hegseth, Mike Waltz, and CIA Director John Ratcliffe. The Department of Health and Human Services announced it's cutting 10,000 jobs. Combined with the wave of early retirements and buyouts since Trump came to power, the department will lose roughly a quarter of its workforce, going from 82,000 down to 62,000 workers. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said agencies will also be consolidated as part of the plan. The cuts will gut key agencies, including the CDC, FDA, and NIH, and set back decades of advances in public health, many charge. Washington Democratic Senator Patty Murray said, quote, in the middle of worsening nationwide outbreaks of bird flu and measles, not to mention a fentanyl epidemic, Trump is wrecking vital health agencies with the precision of a bull in a china shop, the senator said. This comes as a leaked White House memo shows the Trump administration is preparing to lay off between 8 to 50% of federal workers across 22 agencies under the first phase of DOGE cuts. The plan includes axing half the staff at Housing and Urban Development, 30% of the staff of the IRS, and 8% of Justice Department staff. On Tuesday, House Speaker Mike Johnson escalated Republican attacks on judges in the court system, telling reporters Congress could attempt to eliminate federal courts it disagrees with.
We do have authority over the federal courts, as you know. We can eliminate an entire district court. We have power funding over the courts and all these other things.
President Trump Thursday withdrew New York Congressmember Elise Stefanik's nomination for U.N. ambassador, citing fears Republicans could come closer to losing their narrow margin in the House if Stefanik's seat goes up for a special election. This comes after Pennsylvania Democrats won two state elections this week, including a Senate seat in a district that voted for Trump over Kamala Harris by more than 15 points in November. Republicans now hold 218 seats in the House of Representatives. Democrats have 213, and there are four vacant House seats. A New York County clerk refused to enforce a fine from Texas issued to penalize a New York doctor for prescribing online abortion pills to a Texas patient. The Ulster County clerk cited New York State's shield laws. The case is expected to eventually land at the U.S. Supreme Court. In labor news, Trump has signed an executive order stripping union rights from hundreds of thousands of federal workers, ordering 18 departments to stop engaging in any collective bargaining. Trump cited so-called national security concerns. The American Federation of Government Employees is challenging the order in court and said in a statement, quote, "Trump's threat to unions and working people across America is clear. Fall in line or else. These threats will not work," unquote. The Environmental Protection Agency has created a direct email address for industrial polluters like coal-fired power plants to easily request exemptions from the federal government to Clean Air Act rules. The rules include limits on mercury production and other pollutants known to damage human health and the environment. Climate Action Campaign likened the process to a, quote, "gold-plated, get-out-of-permitting-free card," unquote. Robert McChesney, co-founder of the advocacy group Free Press and a tireless defender of media and democracy, has died at the age of 72. Bob McChesney was a prolific author with nearly three dozen books on media democracy and digital rights, including Rich Media, Poor Democracy. He was also a beloved professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Bob McChesney appeared on Democracy Now! Multiple times over the years. In 2016, he addressed corporate consolidation and control over the internet.
We have to really have a serious discussion in this country about why do we pay so much more for broadband access and cell phone service than almost any other country in the world, sometimes by, you know, double, triple the rates for crappier service, is having these private companies who are sort of the equivalent of the health insurance companies gouging us and setting super high prices and paying off the regulators and politicians, a very rational way for a free society to have this central component of our communication infrastructure controlled.
That was Robert McChesney speaking in 2016. He's just died at the age of 72. You can see all of our interviews with him at democracynow.org. And in his latest attack on cultural institutions, President Trump signed an executive order Thursday appointing J.D. Vance to eliminate, quote, "divisive race-centered ideology," unquote, from Smithsonian museums, research centers, and the National Zoo. The order, called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, aims to remove exhibits and programs that portray U.S. history and values as, quote, "inherently harmful and oppressive." It cites in particular the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which opened in 2016. The Smithsonian operates independently since it was established as a public-private partnership by Congress in 1846. It receives roughly 60% of its funding from the federal government. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
And that was a selection of headlines from Democracy Now! More information about the program, including full episodes, can be found at democracynow.com. You're listening to KORC.
This is KORC. News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll. The following is an article by Bill Stevens of Trains.com. The article was published March 20th of 2025 and is entitled "CEO's Dismissal Signals the Beginning of the End for Amtrak: An Analysis." Nothing good will come from the Wednesday, March 19th, dismissal of Amtrak CEO Stephen Gardner, who was pushed out as part of the White House's purge of officials who are not deemed loyal to the re-elected President Donald Trump. The timing of the move was curious. The Trump administration has been seeking to pull funding for programs it deems wasteful or contrary to its priorities. Gardner announced his resignation on March 19th, just 5 days after issuing a statement saying that Amtrak looked forward to receiving the $2.42 billion Congress has appropriated for the fiscal year 2025. Could that be a coincidence? no names have yet been floated about a potential replacement for Gardner. Amtrak needs a CEO who is an experienced railroader and knows the business inside out. Someone who can fix its operational and mechanical woes, improve efficiency, boost revenue, and effectively manage its ballooning capital budget. In other words, someone who has been a Class 1 Railroad Chief Operating Officer. Yet, thus far, the Trump administration has been allergic to expertise. So what Amtrak instead will get as its next CEO is a political hack. He or she will know nothing about passenger trains or railroads, but that won't matter. His or her marching orders will be to dismantle the national network and privatize what's left. During his first term, Trump sought to cut Amtrak funding in half, phase out support for long-distance trains, and block funding for the much-needed Gateway project on the Northeast Corridor in New Jersey and New York. Earlier this month, billionaire tech entrepreneur Elon Musk, who heads the Advisory Department of Government Efficiency as part of the administration's efforts to upend business as usual in Washington, said Amtrak should be privatized. Trump, meanwhile, has a vindictive streak a mile wide, and he clearly wants to erase anything that has predecessor Joe Biden's fingerprints on it. Amtrak Joe's signature achievement was the infrastructure law that sent billions Amtrak's way for new equipment, route expansion, and Northeast Corridor improvement projects. Under the bipartisan infrastructure law, Congress has earmarked $22 billion for Amtrak and $36 billion in federal-state passenger partnerships through fiscal 2026. Much of the grant money remains tied up in the cumbersome Federal Railroad Administration review process, which likely will get further bogged down by job cutbacks at the agency. This means the funding is vulnerable at best. Put all this together, and the inevitable conclusion is that Amtrak as we know it will cease to exist. Long-distance trains will disappear. State-sponsored routes will continue in some form, so long as the states pick up the tab. And the Northeast Corridor will be raffled off to the highest private bidder. Calls to privatize Amtrak, zero out its funding, or eliminate long-distance trains are nothing new. In the past, Republicans who represent rural states in Congress always rode to Amtrak's rescue. Neither they nor their constituents wanted to lose their long-distance trains. At the end of the day, Amtrak always emerged from political scuffles with enough funding to scrape by. Don't expect that to happen in the current environment. If Republicans in Congress are afraid to stand up to Trump's plans to cut 83,000 Veterans Affairs jobs, a move that will only hurt medical care for veterans, they're certainly not going to be willing to take a bullet for Amtrak. All of this underscores the fact that Amtrak is as much a political creature as it is a transportation company. Wick Moorman, the former Norfolk Southern CEO who led Amtrak in 2016 and 2017, says, "I really didn't get a significant amount of political conversation or pressure while I was there. Politics are inevitable, given the role that the FRA plays, and it was sometimes a little frustrating, but nothing more than that. Part of my experience was probably driven by the fact that politicians seemed to be happy that I was there. That's no longer the case. Until now, Amtrak has been able to navigate its way through political controversies. Trump has nominated Robert Gleason, the former state GOP chairman in Pennsylvania, to the Amtrak board. Gleason has championed expanding Amtrak service in the Keystone State, but by pushing Gardner out, the White House has kneecapped the Amtrak board and made it irrelevant. Elon Musk has called Amtrak a national embarrassment, saying it falls well short of providing world-class service. He's not wrong. But you get what you pay for. Comparing U.S. passenger rail to well-funded systems in Europe, Japan, or China is an unfair apples-to-oranges comparison given our relatively meager spending on Amtrak, and the fact that most of its routes must operate over host freight railroads. Instead of decimating Amtrak, why not provide the funding and proper oversight required to make passenger rail great again? Flying is a hassle. Driving gridlocked interstates is a nightmare. On trips under 500 miles, there's no better way to travel than on a passenger train. That was an article written by Bill Stevens at trains.com. It was published March 20th of 2025. The title is CEO's Dismissal Signals the Beginning of the End for Amtrak, an analysis. You can find the article online at trains.com, TRAINS.com. For KORC, News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Kroll.
Bought a ticket for a runaway train, like a madman laughing at the rain. A little out of touch, little insane. It's just easier than dealing with the pain. Runaway train, never going back. Wrong way on a one-way track. I should be getting somewhere. Somehow I'm neither here nor there. Runaway train, never coming back. Runaway train, tearing up the track. Runaway train, burning.